Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand and Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand.
Romanian secret police agents watched her and persuaded friends to report on her activities. The agents took pictures of her when she was in her underwear. About 70 informants and spies watched Catherine Verderi when she visited Romania in the 1970s and 1980s. At the time, the country was under Communist Party rule. Verderi went to Romania for postgraduate research on village life. She is now an anthropology professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. After the collapse of communism in 1989, Verderi was given a copy of the once secret records about her activities. The documentation covered 2,781 pages. She used them for her book, which is called My Life as a Spy. Verderi wrote the book in English. It was recently published in the Romanian language, a move that has opened old wounds. Her story is forcing Romanians to face a dark period in their history. Verderi admits being a young and innocent American when she first went to Eastern Europe. She failed to understand what her questions and efforts to become part of Romanian society looked like to other people. Under communist rule, Romanians considered Americans sent to Romania for study programs to be Western spies. Verderi did nothing to stop the idea. Once, she mistakenly rode her motorcycle onto a military base. By the end of her research, the officer responsible for her case decided she was not a spy. When Verderi first learned of the existence of the secret police records, she was absolutely stunned. "I couldn't believe my eyes. The level of surveillance was so much greater than anything I had imagined." Romanian Securitate agents reported on her movements, sometimes up to 16 hours a day. Hotel employees reported where she went. Others looked at her belongings to read her research notes. She was filmed and recorded everywhere, and friends reported on her. Romanian officials feared she would present Romania badly or could affect the country's most favored nation position. Under international rules, a most favored nation can openly trade with other nations. Angry and sad, Verderi returned to Romania to understand why she had been a target for the secret police. "They assumed that I was a spy," she told the Associated Press by telephone from Massachusetts. "Finding out my friends were involved working with the secret police was an unwelcome surprise." Back in Romania, she met and discussed events with former close friends and co-workers. Some people denied watching her. Others had died. One woman blamed Verderi for making her become an informer. Only one person apologized. Verderi forgave everyone. Verderi believes spying is a product of culture. She understands why people might think she was a spy. She took notes and kept copies. Later, she sent them to the United States, mail that was shipped directly from the U.S. Embassy in Bucharest. Verderi does not name the friends who spied on her, but records that have appeared in Romanian media show they included two former government ministers. Unlike other former communist countries, Romania has yet to deal with the destructive effect its secret police had on the country. Everyone was watched. Nearly everyone was an informer. People lived without trust. Observers say the old system continues to operate. It's as alive as it was before, and we haven't healed yet, said Arman Gosu, a teacher at the University of Bucharest. But the publication of My Life as a Spy in Romanian last month seems to be having an effect. The book has sold out as Romanians seem prepared to discuss their past. I'm Susan Shand.
When was the last time you experienced a wide range of emotions over something? From sadness to happiness, or even a sense of relief when a problem was solved. Perhaps you moved to a new city or returned home. Maybe you lost or gained something valuable. Or you may have overcome a serious personal issue or enjoyed success after defeat. If you are like most people, there are things in life that can take your emotions in many directions. And in English, there are a lot of phrasal verbs to help express those emotions. Today, we will tell you about some of them. You will remember that a phrasal verb is a verb made of two or more words, a verb and a preposition or adverb, or both. Phrasal verbs for emotions can be used in many different situations, but let's begin with a situation that is very relatable, a family gathering. In many countries, extended families gather only a few times each year. Children and their parents join up with one or more grandparents, aunts, uncles, and other relatives. They often gather in one place, perhaps someone's home, to enjoy a special dinner and quality time as a family. And with everyone together, things are not always perfect. There are almost guaranteed to be many reactions, laughter, smiles, maybe even some crying. Okay, now imagine that a large family is seated together at a dining table. They are having that special meal. As they eat, predictably, the talk turns to work and careers. Everyone praises one of the youngsters for getting accepted to a university. They praise another family member for landing a job they worked hard to get. But then the talk turns to a young man and his sister. The brother has some interesting words about her career. Listen to this short exchange.
Next month,
Zadie is going to culinary school. Culinary school. Let us know how that goes.
You know, your jokes are really getting to me. Maybe you should loosen up. Not everyone wants to be an engineer. And by the way, I'm planning to become an executive chef.
Zadie's brother's words got to her. If something gets to you, it bothers you and fuels anger. She tells her brother to loosen up, to be more easygoing, to lighten up about her personal choices. A few other family members then show support for Zadie's decision. They tell her how much they wish they had followed their dreams at her age. Now, at the other end of the table, a heated exchange is taking place. Uncle Louis has strong opinions and loves to speak his mind at family dinners. Some family members like his openness. Others find him obnoxious. They think he is being a pain. Listen to a short exchange.
And that's why, even though the lamb roast looks great, I'm not having any. Red meat is bad for the climate. Starting tomorrow, all of you should make a plan to...
Uncle Louis, you're giving me a headache. You always say things at the wrong time. Let the rest of us enjoy the meal, please.
Okay, but calm down. It's fine that you disagree, but that's no reason to lash out at me. Now, can we shake hands and agree to disagree?
Okay, sure.
Uncle Louis had told his niece to calm down. To calm down means to become less emotional or excited, or to help someone else feel this way. Calm down is often used in imperative statements. It is used as a command. In imperative statements, we usually do not separate the words calm and down, but in other kinds of statements, the verb may be separated by an object. You may recall that some phrasal verbs are separable. They can be separated by objects. We could, for example, say, the father calmed his baby down by singing to her. The words, his baby, are the object. Uncle Louis also tells his niece not to lash out at him. Did you understand the meaning of lash out at? Listen to the sentence again.
It's fine that you disagree, but that's no reason to lash out at me.
To lash out at someone means to make a sudden and angry attack on them. Back at the center of the table, Grandpa is remembering the way things used to be. Let's listen in.
I don't think I'll ever get over the fact that I only see you all a few times every year. I remember when we all lived in the same state.
Aw, Grandpa, cheer up. You are always welcomed to stay with us in Washington. We have an extra bedroom with a television. And don't forget, there is video chat. I talk with Zadie on video all the time.
Michelle tells her grandfather to cheer up. To cheer up means to become happier or to make someone else happier. In most imperative statements, we do not separate the words cheer and up. But in other statements, the verb can be separable. For example, one could say, I'm cheering Grandpa up. The word grandpa is the object. Now it's time for the big news of the family gathering. Let's listen.
I have an announcement to make. We're having a baby. A little girl. She's due in late June.
Oh my goodness, Sean. That's exciting. I'm so happy for you that I could cry. See, now I'm choking up.
To choke up means to have difficulty speaking because of strong emotions. In American English, we often put the verb get before choke up. We also often add the word all. Let's hear how that sounds.
See, now I'm getting all choked up.
When we say it this way, the words choked up act as an adjective. There are a lot of ways to express emotions in English, and phrasal verbs can help us express them more fully. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we continue the story of America's 36th president, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Johnson was vice president to John F. Kennedy. Kennedy was murdered in Dallas in November of 1963. Johnson served the last 14 months of the president's term. Then he won a full term of his own starting in January 1965. Most of Johnson's time and energy would be taken up by the war in Vietnam. By early 1964, America had about 17,000 troops in Vietnam. The troops were there to advise and train the South Vietnamese military. Vietnam had gained its independence from France in 1954. The country was divided into North and South. The North had a communist government led by Ho Chi Minh. The South had an anti-communist government led by Ngo Dinh Diem. In 1957, communist rebels, the Viet Cong, launched a violent campaign in the South. They were supported by the government of North Vietnam and later by North Vietnamese troops. Their goal was to overthrow the government in the South. President Johnson believed that the United States had to support South Vietnam. Many Americans agreed. They believed that without American help, South Vietnam would become communist. There were concerns about the so-called domino theory, that if South Vietnam fell, other Southeast Asian countries would also fall to communists. As Johnson began his full term, his military advisors told him the communists were losing the war. They told him that North Vietnamese troops and Viet Cong forces would soon stop fighting. On February 6, 1965, however, the Viet Cong attacked American camps at Pleiku and Quinon. The Johnson administration immediately ordered airstrikes against military targets in the North. Some observers in the United States questioned the administration's policy. James Reston of the New York Times, for example, said President Johnson was carrying out an undeclared war in Vietnam. In March 1965, the first American combat troops arrived in South Vietnam. Congress supported the president's actions at that time. However, the number of Americans who opposed the war began to grow. These people said it was a civil war. They said the United States had no right or reason to intervene. For 6 days in May, the United States halted bombing of North Vietnam. The administration hoped this would help get the North Vietnamese government to begin negotiations. The North refused, and the United States began to build up its forces in the South. By July, 125,000 Americans were fighting in Vietnam. some Americans became angry. Anti-war demonstrations took place in San Francisco and Chicago. More and more students began to protest. They wanted the war to end quickly. Some people thought the anti-war demonstrations were only delaying peace in Vietnam. James Reston believed the demonstrations would make Ho Chi Minh think America did not support its troops. And that, he said, would only make him continue the war. In December of 1965, the United States again halted its air campaign against North Vietnam. Again, it invited the North Vietnamese government to negotiate an end to the fighting. And again, the North refused. Ho Chi Minh's conditions for peace were firm. He demanded an end to the bombing and a complete American withdrawal. Withdrawal would mean defeat for the South. It would mean that all of Vietnam would become communist. President Johnson would not accept these terms, so he offered his own proposals. The most important was an immediate ceasefire. Neither side would compromise, however, and the fighting went on. In 1966, President Johnson renewed the bombing in North Vietnam. He also increased the number of American troops in South Vietnam. was also a year for congressional elections. The opposition Republican Party generally supported the war efforts of Lyndon Johnson, who was a Democrat. But it criticized him and other Democrats for economic problems connected to the war. The war cost $2 billion every month. The price of many goods in the United States began to rise. The value of the dollar began to drop. Americans faced inflation and then a recession. To answer the criticism, administration officials said progress was being made in Vietnam, but some Americans began to suspect that the government was not telling the truth about the war. Opposition to the war led to bigger and bigger demonstrations. In July 1967, just over half the people questioned for opinion surveys said they did not approve of the president's policies. But most Americans believed that Johnson would run again for president the next year. Johnson strongly defended the use of American troops in Vietnam. In a speech to a group of lawmakers, he said, "Since World War II, this nation has met and has mastered many challenges. Challenges in Greece and Turkey, in Berlin, in Korea, in Cuba. We met them because brave men were willing to risk their lives for their nation's security. And braver men have never lived than those who carry our colors in Vietnam at this very hour." The price of these efforts, of course, has been heavy. But the price of not having made them at all, not having seen them through, in my judgment, would have been vastly greater. Then came Tet, the Vietnamese Lunar New Year, in January 1968. The communists launched a major military campaign. They attacked 31 of the 44 provinces of South Vietnam. They also struck at the American embassy in the capital, Saigon.
Military police got back into the compound of the $2.5 million embassy complex at dawn. Before that, a platoon of Viet Cong were in control. The communist raiders never got into the main chancery building. A handful of Marines had it locked and kept them out. But the raiders were everywhere else.
CBS News reporter George Sievertson described more of the fighting in Saigon and how it affected civilians in a poor part of the city.
This neighborhood is called the chessboard because of the maze of alleys and passageways. Its residents are mostly poor working people, and its slums are a refuge for Saigon's hoodlum and criminal elements. Vietnamese Rangers and Marines moved carefully, blasting buildings and possible Viet Cong hiding places before moving ahead. This was the first time heavy fighting has taken place in Saigon proper. Until now, most of it has been in the Chinese section of Cholon and in the suburbs. The VC were difficult to dislodge. They obviously knew the section well and had built barricades in key spots. The Rangers and Marines took casualties, mostly from hidden snipers. As soon as a section had been cleared, more terror-stricken civilians scurried out of their homes, thousands of them fleeing from the bullets and explosives, and even more dangerous, a fire that began to rage out of control. Residents in nearby buildings began dragging their most precious possessions out of their shops and homes. Saigon's water supply system is operating only at 70% of normal, so fires are a serious menace. For these people, many of them who fled the war from outlying villages, this is the cruelest blow. The curfew has kept them from making a living. Food prices have tripled since the fighting began a week ago. And now, their homes are being destroyed.
Thousands of people were killed in the Tet Offensive. The communists suffered heavier losses than the South Vietnamese or the Americans. But many Americans were surprised that the communists could launch such a major attack against South Vietnam. For several years, they had been told that communist forces were small and losing badly. General William Westmoreland, commander of U.S. military operations in Vietnam, spoke with reporter George Sievertson.
General, how would you assess yesterday's activities and today's? What is the enemy doing? Are these major attacks or...
The enemy, very deceitfully, has taken advantage of the Tet Truce in order to create maximum consternation within South Vietnam, particularly in the populated areas. Now, yesterday, the enemy exposed himself by virtue of this strategy, and he suffered great casualties.
As a result of the offensive, popular support for the administration fell even more. Democrats who opposed President Johnson seized this chance. Several ran against him for the party's nomination in 1968. These included Senator Robert Kennedy of New York and Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota. Kennedy and McCarthy did well in the early primary elections. Johnson did poorly. At the end of March 1968, the president spoke to the American people. He discussed his proposal to end American bombing of North Vietnam. He talked about his appointment of a special ambassador to start peace negotiations. And he announced his decision about his own future.
I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office, the presidency of your country. Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Another major issue facing America in the 1960s was the civil rights movement, which sought to ensure equal rights for black Americans.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.